Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Rowing Chat. And today I'm joined by Gwyn Batten. Gwyn, welcome to Rowing Chat.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be on.
Now, could you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background in rowing?
Yeah, I guess I came to rowing really late. I came to rowing when I was about 19 while I was studying at university at Southampton in the UK. And very much went down a route of wanting to become a sports scientist at the Olympics. I didn't realize how I would eventually get good enough to go as an athlete. And just before the 96 games, I was Jürgen's physiologist going into the 96 games, the British Olympic team. But then suddenly everything changed and I became an athlete, spent 10 years as a performance athlete, rowing at World Championships, Olympic Games, won a silver medal in Sydney for Great Britain in the women's quad. And then very much journeyed through into coaching, had to make a career and an income. So I had to put that first, but very much came back into the sport through umpiring and sitting on as an athlete representative on FISA, going into the Youth Commission, and then eventually getting onto council and chairing the Rowing for All Commission. Domestically in the UK, I am chair of the Women's Eights Head of the River Race, which is an amazingly fantastic race that happens in the UK in the beginning of March, the end of our winter training, which has around 3,000 women racing in eights. And I also sit on the management committee for Henley World Regatta.
You are a busy person. Now, obviously, the most of what you've talked through there is about what we would call traditional straight boat racing, using boats authorised by FISA. But I know you've also looked at other ways of propelling boats, and yeah, you've raced in other formats.
Absolutely. I mean, I very much my first love when I was a kid. My parents lived out in the Middle East, and I just wanted to be on the water when you got the heat. And my first love was just anything. And when I left school, I worked on a sail training boat called Jolly Breeze in 1913, French pilot cutter. And you know, I really liked the edge of adventure. I really liked the challenge of being out there in nature. And our Olympic sport, while it's incredibly exciting to take our bodies and our physiologies to the edge, there's something quite cool about taking rowing boats to the edge of possibility. And there's some, you know, really, really exciting boat types that are out there. You know, our heritage and our traditional boat types, there's just amazing opportunities to travel the world and to see them.
So you went to the South Pacific, am I right? Tell us about what you did there.
Yeah, well, to be honest, my venture into the sea, et cetera, after I'd retired from rowing was very much, I went into dragon boating as a deal because I needed an athlete to come into the squad that I was coaching. And the deal was I would then go into dragon boating and represent Great Britain. And we went off and did the Europeans and the Worlds. And while dragon boating is exciting, it's a power-based sport, not an endurance-based sport. And, you know, for health reasons, you want to do an endurance-based sport. So that gravitated me into outrigger canoeing, which is an exceptionally exciting sport based around the Pacific Rim, and really does take the emphasis of working big, deep ocean swell to an extreme. You know, the Molokai, which is a very, very famous channel on the edge of Oahu. And you know, you finish on Waikiki Beach, you're racing 7 hours out in the ocean, dropping people into the ocean to change the cruise. Incredibly exciting. And then at around about the same time as I was the athlete representative going to the World Coastal Championships in Cannes, Mandalu, and I saw these boats and it was like, oh my God, these are amazing. I can do everything I wanted to do in outrigger canoeing, but in rowing and going faster. And so I fell in love with the discipline, and I've had the real pleasure and to be around, to be embraced into the sport of coastal, and to be helping its development into the beach rowing format, which we were able to design and develop specifically for the emerging beach games that are starting to come onto the scene at the moment.
So, coastal rowing. I personally have seen coastal rowing boats and I have rowed in them, and I know that they row in the British National Championships, and they're wide, they're sliding seat boats, slightly wider than a fine boat. Is that what you did, what they use in the Coastal Rowing Championships?
Yeah, so the class, I think you know, I think the class is a really emerging class, and it's emerging every single year. More and more countries are coming to it. It's a class that was came out of the in the late 80s, was developed in, by the French. They codified the sport. They found that their coastal rowing clubs were very much starting to look inshore, very much looking at the Olympic river and lake rowing, and not really making full advantage of the estuaries and the, you know, the coastline that they had, and that they were dying. And so the French, in the way that the French are so well organized, pretty much galvanized their clubs, designed this particular boat. It's a much wider, more robust boat than we use in the UK in our coastal rowing. And so in the UK, we tend to call it offshore rowing, but in the rest of the world, we call it coastal rowing. And it's, they're heavy boats. They are, singles are about 30 kilos. The and the quads, Cox quads, go up to just under, it's about 40 kilos. You can look at the rules to get the exact ones. I should know them off the top of my head because I've been spending quite a lot of time working with the boat builders to ensure that we have the best possible weights. But they're really exciting, and they love nothing better than a good 2 meter rolling swell offshore, about a mile offshore. And there's a real skill to working them down wind, a real skill that river and lake rowers haven't quite mastered yet.
So how do they race? Do they go out round buoys and back, or launch them?
Yeah, so if you think about our river and lake rowing, if you think about that, it's a very fast, very sharp, everything's controlled, you know, even to the point where, you know, we have a fairness committee that's worried about the wind across the lanes. So it's very controlled. So if you can imagine that, it's like cycling in a velodrome. You know, everything's under control. And you then think of the other class in cycling. You think of mountain biking. Think of the guys, and there's two disciplines in mountain biking, predominantly. There's the endurance discipline, and then there's the downhill discipline. And so coastal rowing, which has the world championships in it, this 6 kilometer course, either off for the beach or a floating start, depending on where we're located. And then we race round the Cairns for a 6 kilometer course, and then come back either onto a floating finish line or onto the beach, again, depending on where we hold the championships. There's a lot of carnage around the first buoy. And you know, we've had races up to 20 boats on the start line. We have the first buoy 1 kilometer. So you can imagine how good you have to be to make sure you don't get into trouble as you come around that first buoy line. First boy, it's incredibly exciting. It's incredibly exciting to be in a boat, in one of the boats. Incredibly exciting to watch if you can get out there and see it happening. So that's very much the enduro version of coastal. And then we have the beach, the emerging beach discipline, which is side by side race. We have you're basically singles, doubles, and coxed quads. You pretty much run 10 meters down the beach. The boat's already on the water. The runner gets into the boat and they're off. They do a slalom out and slalom back 250 meters out, 250 meters back. And then one of the runners makes it back up over the beach. Specifically designed on a swimming beach, not on a surf beach. We'll leave that at big waves for the pros, for the surf rowers, with their really incredible skill that they do to break the surf. But it's incredibly exciting. We've designed it in such a way that we have really high jeopardy. The idea is that it's designed specifically for the audience to be able to see everything. When you get down to the last eight, we race until there's a winner. You know, so that element of endurance is incredibly high. So if you're going to go on and win, you've got to put 3 back-to-back races together. There's just some elements we've added into it that make it really exciting for the spectators, incredibly fast-paced for the rowers. So even to the point where you choose your lane 10 minutes for it, so you'll have a committee boat, so you don't even know which boat you're going to go into until till your opposition or you have chosen the lane, depending on who has the fastest time. So your pit crew are starting to get your boat ready. You know, it's just amazingly high octane and high jeopardy.
So let's just run through a few phrases you used that I'm not familiar with. When you said cans, I'm guessing you mean buoys or buoys, as our American friends call them.
Yeah, or in international English, turning points. There you go.
Excellent. And what does it mean when you say they slalom out from the beach?
Yeah, so the 250 lane, there's three buoys on that, and the furthest buoy out will be at 250 meters. So they'll turn around and come back. Depending on where the surf break is and the depth of the water, the other two buoys will be positioned between that time. So they need to move around the buoys as they go
so
out.
So it's not a straight line.
Not a straight line. And so your rowing agility becomes your ability to place your bows exactly where you need them. Becomes a really integral part of being a beach sprint rower.
Now, I'd love to know a little bit more about this. So you've got four people in the boat and a coxswain, steersman?
Yeah, so there's three classes. You've got the solo, the single, you've got the double and the cox quad.
And how, let's focus on the cox quad. How does the coxswain presumably is giving the commands. What are the sorts of things that he has to get you to do in order to turn the boat and to respond to the wave and water conditions?
Well, actually, the steering in the quads, certain quad designs can turn on sixpence. You know, they absolutely have their rudders. And in fact, if you're an inexperienced person, you could actually get your boat suddenly into a turn without realising. So they are very quick to come round. The boats that are much harder to bring round and use a lot of energy are, of course, the solo and the double. To come around that and do a 180 degree turn. It's a big power output at that point in the race when you've been sprinting for 250 meters to then put that in. The coxswains tend to, I mean, the French at the Mediterranean Beach Games where the format was first held, the French did an incredible combination of how they used their runners and their setups. And the rules also allow two boat handlers to be supporting the boat. So you usually have two coaches helping you on your steering as you come out, they're signing from the beach and holding the boat in the right position, especially for the solo. You need someone to hold the boat when they're running down the beach. So really excited. We've learned so much with so many different sports. I mean, the boat handlers came from the New Jersey Dorymen, just south in New Jersey. It's incredible surf that they go out on with some very small fixed seat dories. And their boat handlers there do make it incredibly exciting. We've stolen from everywhere.
How do you turn around a buoy then? What's the technique?
Well, you just come into it as, you probably go a bit like you do in your car. You probably go a little bit wider as you come in. And then you pretty much try and maintain as much momentum going round until your boat's come to a standstill. And then you put the... Put the inside oar in hard, and then bring the bow around. I mean, in the double, you'll probably play a combination between your bow and your stroke. And in the single, you'll pretty much, bury your shaft rather than back it down. All the sort of things that you do when you're trying to do UT2 training on a 1,000 meter course to keep your heart rate up. Probably pretty similar sort of things, except this time you're doing it at speed.
So the boats, are they designed so that if you get water inside the cockpit, it'll wash out again as you start rowing? Have they got sort of those, call them in the hull, where they flip and they flip the water out as you row?
The back end, yeah. Can you hear me okay? The back end is completely open.
Okay.
So if you backed your boat down, you'd fill up with water. And as soon as you start moving, it's just straight out the back. So the idea is that when you come through a big wave and you have the whole of the wave just plants itself in the boat, it just empties straight out the back. So
there's no fear of filling up and sinking. You basically, it's designed to take water on and then to enable you to get water out while you row.
Yeah, I mean, we came, I was racing off Devon, south coast of Devon a few years back, and we came down and a pretty big, we were 200 meters offshore, so the waves were just starting to stand up a bit, and a wave came out of nowhere, and we were literally going as fast as you can row sideways, and our heads were the only thing that was visible above the waves. And we were fine. We just braced our oars out and were surfing sideways until the wave passed through us. And then we just carried on rowing. I've been racing Plymouth at the World Championships where you were two lengths ahead of the other quads. And then all of a sudden you were engulfed by a wave and your opposition was two lengths ahead, and it's exciting. It's really exciting. And I just something that they're set up exactly the same way as riverboats are in their dimensions, so it's really easy to step from one sport to the other as long as you've got the understanding of how the sea works.
as long as, and I guess there's an enormous amount of learning in that one brief phrase.
Yeah.
So if someone would like to learn more about beach rowing, where do they go to get information about it?
So on beach rowing at the moment, we've really only got press stories out there and, you know, starting to just explain the story. We're working very hard to get those into the beach games. So if there are people out there who are really interested in running beach sprint events, etc., the first thing they probably need to do is to start looking at the coastal design of boats. And there's some fantastic, we've got about 8 or 9 manufacturers now around the world making coastal boats. Some of the manufacturers have been in the game since the outset in the late 80s when the French introduced it. So go and look at boat builders like the Eurodiffusion, etc. The Italians are doing some great work. And Filippi are making some lovely coastal boats. And then we've got, you know, our Chinese builders out there building some very competitive ones on price. Scandinavia, we've got some builders up there, Mats Leo, you know, there are some really lovely design boats from very small boat builders from Portugal to Spain, some builders in the UK building. So, you know, there's a really, really interesting, desperately keen to get builders out in America starting, and hopefully soon that will happen.
So
get your hands on the boats. And really your best bet, I think, is to come to the World Coastal Championships. Do the enduro version first, start to learn how the boats operate. And that's where, you know, pretty much as long as you're a member of a club in your national federation, you can come out and come and race at the World Championships. This year, we're taking a bit of a leap. The World Championships are in Toulon, which are on Lake Geneva. So it's our first time we've got the World Coastals on an inland sea. For those people who've ever rowed on Lake Geneva can be a very tempestuous inland sea because of the Alps. The impact of the wind from the Alps, it absolutely rattles down there. So if you think the waves are going to be small on Lake Geneva, think again.
And the date of that event?
So the date of that event is, you're getting me here, right?
Approximately.
Third weekend in October.
October. And in the UK, listeners, if you want to get into coastal rowing clubs, British Rowing website has got all the details. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. For the guys in the UK, there's 2 really exciting clubs who've been around now for about 10 years each. One down in Plymouth, at Mayflower, and then Exmouth Rowing Club. Really, both those clubs have been really pioneering that side of the sport. And then there's quite a big group of FISA coastal boats in Wales. Really competitive in Wales. And of course, the guys that really helped FISA at the very outset of it in the UK with the Channel Islands. And we had the first practice world championships in the Channel Islands. So, you know, really exciting. But, you know, we've had people from traipsing down from London and coming, you know, don't limit yourself by not being on the sea. There's a real commonality between rowing and coastal rowing.
Fantastic. So I think an encouragement there for anybody to get in touch, have a go. But let's track back to what I might call traditional formats and traditional races. Where do you feel the future of the sport is when we have things like the Wingfield Sculls, which is a very long-standing private match held on the Tideway? And how does that potentially integrate with the outrigger canoes that you mentioned earlier and things like Cornish gig racing? And I know there are some Welsh traditional boats that are also reviving in popularity.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to recognise is our sport is a heritage sport. And we come from, you know, from the truck drivers and the taxi drivers and the pilots. And, you know, we come out of a profession and the... It's really important that we recognise the heritage that our sport's from. There is also, I'm going to have a bit of a drink. You know, so if you think about where river and lake rowing came from, it came from the taxi drivers in the UK. They came from in Newcastle and in London, etc. The new dimension of which the sliding seat came in very late. So that's why there's been quite a lot of homogeneousness around river and lake rowing, and the Olympics helped us codify that very tightly. But I think, sorry about this.
Take your time.
I think about the cigarettes. But I might have to edit this bit. So I think if you start looking at the disciplines of the boats, I think we really need as a sport to understand how we protect the heritage that where we came from. Where do we protect the heritage of the gig racing, who actually at the moment I don't need any protecting, so they're doing an incredible job and doing some incredible revival and work within their communities. But again, there are smaller boats in probably countries where rowing is not seen as a sport. I've been doing quite a lot of work out in the Maldives. And, you know, the guys that know how to row, they're in their 60s and 70s because of the outboard engine started to lose the connection between rowing. And I think there is, over the next 10 or 15 years, we need to work quite quickly to help make sure that we protect the heritage of our sport in the local areas that those boats are left from. I mean, you know, there's some crazy stuff out there. I mean, I talked earlier about the New Jersey Dorymen. There's the fantastic ice canoe that comes up in St. Lawrence River, where they've been able to develop it as a sport. In Samoa, they have 50 men fixed seat rowing boats, which are the craziest things I've ever seen, that race on their, I think it's on their Independence Day. And, you know, there's some amazing boats still out there. We need to find them, celebrate them. But at the same time, if we go forward, sorry, go for it.
I was going to say, the St. Lawrence River ice boat is on YouTube. And my understanding of this is it's a 4 or 6 man boat and you row in heavy walking boots. And when the ice is flowing down the river, so it's as the St. Lawrence River melts, you have to get round a triangular course. It's a very fast flowing river. And when your boat gets close to an ice flow, you hop out and you have crampons on the bottom of your boots and you carry your boat across an iceberg and pop it in on the far side and hop back in again and carry on rowing. And apparently sometimes the race doesn't have a winner because they don't get round the course before the time limit expires. Is that the race I'm thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, again, like you, I've only ever seen it and spoken to people that have done it. I've only ever seen it on YouTube or spoken to people that have done it. They have spikes on the bottom of their shoes, and inside the boats themselves, they have foam to be able to make sure they don't put their spikes through the bottom of the boat. Yeah, they're pushing their boat over. I wouldn't say they're lifting it. They're pushing it over, one knee in the boat and one leg out and sliding it over the ice as they go.
That's
right. It all comes back to the heritage of who was going to get the first bag of fresh supplies back to town when they saw a ship coming onto the edge of the ice floe.
So opportunities for rowers, you'd encourage them to go and find whatever their local heritage version of let's call it man-propelled boats as opposed to wind-propelled boats, and get involved. Go and have a go, see if you enjoy it, try something different, don't just stick to what you know.
Absolutely, definitely. I agree with that. And, you know, think about how we can integrate some of those traditional boats into traditional competition formats. You know, for example, like the Wingfields. The Wingfields is very much in the UK, got a very long heritage, but primarily from the amateur era. It's very interesting. In the UK, we have the amateur era, but that link back to heritage goes back to our professional roots as a sport. Mm-hmm. And I think that in many countries, that disconnect hasn't been reconnected.
So opportunities there for lots of fun, but also a bit of understanding of history and context, and then modernization. So you talked about the beach games earlier. I have never heard of the beach games. What is it?
Yeah, so there's an emerging multi-sport revival generally in a political level across the world. And, you know, in the same way that they have the Masters Games, they have the World Games, they have the X Games. And there is a push, and that has been on the table for quite a long time now, to have a beach games. That's, again, it's come and gone over the last 5 or 6 years. And there is a proposal at the moment to have a World Beach Games in 2019 at the moment. We're working very hard to get rowing into that program. And by what we really noticed is that quite a few of the sports that are held in the beach games that are out there you know, the smaller regional ones like the Asian Beach Games and the Mediterranean Beach Games. Some of the other formats are very, you know, they're not making full use of the beach and the water. And I think one of the great things that the discipline that we've been able to pull out is that we're connecting the water and the beach together. And there's a couple of sports that are really doing that, and it helps to really, rather than just, I don't know, we could put rowing machines on the beach and say that we're doing beach rowing, but really, you know, we're embracing the sand, we're embracing the zone between the sand and the water, and then we're going a little bit offshore and coming back in. I think the narrative of that is more compelling.
Rather than just beach volleyball, which is volleyball played on sand and it has nothing to do with water.
Well, no, I think, you see, the real added dimension of beach volleyball, of course, is that they've put themselves in the sand. And so the extra strain and the extra dimension that that places on the game is really exciting. You know, what they're not doing is putting down an artificial surface and playing volleyball, you know. And then also in the same way that with the football, they're playing that on sand. The energy sap of sand is amazing. There are a couple of sports that are putting artificial surfaces down and then playing their sports.
Well, best of luck for getting rowing into the beach games. And the other thing that you talked about were committee boats. And just to clarify, this is when the event organisers provide the boats and the athletes just turn up with their oars on the day.
Yeah, so one of the key things for us is, if, you know, we want to reduce the cost for the athletes travelling. And so at both the beach games format and at the World Rowing Coastal Championships, there are boats supplied by the organisers. You can, at the World Rowing Coastal Championships, you can bring your own boat, which I think if you're pretty serious, you're going to try and do that. But if you're coming in, you don't have a lot of money, there are pool boats which you can hire out, you share it with other people, you know, so quite often it's going to be used in the race before you, and you might have a 15-minute turnaround to get the boats rigged up for you, so you can get out and race it. But it makes for an amazing, you know, I mean, the World Championships I won in the double, you know, we were sharing the boat with five other crews, you know, and, you know, you work together, you know, you say, oh, as soon as you finish the race, will you come in? You know, oh, yeah, can we put a bit of tape on the oars so we know how to move our, you know, the buttons up and down and stuff? And they are, oh, you're rigging the boat, brilliant. So me and Lenka, we did all the rigging of the boats, and yeah, but it was lovely. And you made, you felt like a team. Your boat, you know, boat number 15 was the team boat. So it's good fun. It's a lovely way to compete. Lovely way to compete.
I enjoy your enthusiasm for it. Now, I want to track back, though, to more traditional forms of rowing and specifically talk about what's happening right now with regard to the future of rowing in the Olympics, because you are part of the FISA delegation that I believe is travelling to Tokyo next weekend. Can you tell us what's going to be happening in Tokyo?
Yeah, so once every 4 years, we have an opportunity to relook at our rules and to make changes. And that opportunity is called the Extraordinary Congress. And the weekend coming up, we will be organisers in Tokyo will be hosting the Extraordinary Congress. We'll have, Congress is represented by every single rowing nation in the world. They'll either come with three boats or one boat, depending on the number of boats that they take to a World Championships over the preceding couple of years. I sit on FISA Council, and on FISA Council, we have looked very hard and worked with the national federations to try and find options which would work for our sport to react to the IOC's 2020 agenda. And the IOC's 2020 agenda is very much looking to sports and to step up to the plate and address the fundamental issues of parity, so balance between male and female, and of course the universality of the sports, you know, how popular is the sport, etc. There are a lot of other much more complex factors that the IOC are looking at. And also one of the interesting things that they put forward in their agenda was that there was no such thing as a sport anymore. They were starting to look at the events. So they're looking at the individual success, etc., of events rather than sports. So rather than say, we're going to throw X sport out and bring X sport in, they're looking very carefully at the disciplines, etc., within it. And one of the challenges that we have is that we're not particularly high rated on our parity, on our parity between male and female, and we have to address that. We have to address that, in essence, for our survival going forward as a sport. and also we need to address the balance around universality. And there are a lot of things that we can do in both sectors. But but again, we have to take, as the FISA Council, we can only put recommendations forward to Extraordinary Congress. It will be the members of Congress, it will be the national federations themselves that make that vote. And we will be making a, Congress will be voting on that next weekend. And that will be sent as our sports recommendation to the IOC Executive Committee to make the decisions. We know from past experiences that the IOC Executive Committee is, you know, it's quite an unpredictable beast. You know, there's a lot of individuals from a lot of different nations in there, and we don't know how the IOC, not the executive, with the IOC members, we don't know how those IOC members will vote. And so over the last 3 years, JC has tried to ensure that we can put our recommendations forward that would put rowing in the best possible light. I think we have that with the option that we are going to put forward to Congress.
So JC is Jean-Christophe Rond, who's the president of FISA at the moment. And FISA discussed internally three options, and you say now they've chosen one. Which is the one they've chosen?
Well, I think my best advice is, rather than listen to me, would be to go on to the World Rowing website. And there is a really nice article that came out about 5 days ago that explains the two options that are on the table and explains the rationale as to why. I think if there was one thing I was going to say on the blog here now, because I know a lot of people will be listening to this after the event, is that, you know, the Olympic Games, the rowing doesn't choose which events going forward will be at the Olympic Games. It's the IOC that make those choices. We can make suggestions, but at the end of the day, those choices are not necessarily there for us to take. It's a very tactical game. There's a lot of factors in there. And I fundamentally believe that at the bottom of our heart, we want to be able to present rowing in the best possible light, in the most exciting format. And if you look at the other sports that are in the Olympics, there is something really unique about rowing. A, we're on the water, but B, we're an endurance power sport. And there aren't that many endurance power sports that are out there. If we do things like shorten our distance, we'll make ourselves much more like other sports rather than be unique and stand out. So there's some really great bits about rowing, but we haven't explained them to everyone. You know, we have to shout about the uniqueness of our sport.
So rowing at the Olympics has not fundamentally changed its format since the Olympics began. And yet other sports, I'm going to take cycling as an example. You've already mentioned that there are already two disciplines in mountain biking alone. There's a lot of different race formats in the velodrome. There's road cycling. Now, do you think rowing has a future in different formats? And the most obvious one, of course, is to say indoor rowing as a discipline, as well as the traditional 2000 meter straight lane racing.
I think absolutely. I think our fundamental priority is to have the heritage of that 2000 meter racing held in there. The racing at the Olympics is so exciting. You know, the crowds that we have at the Olympics are stunning. The racing is stunning. I don't think anybody questions that is not exciting. I think, we would want to hold that. We would want to have lightweights in it. We want to have as many male and female rowers in it, etc. But we are limited, and the sport is limited, and the IOC are putting limits on that. So we have to work within those boundaries. Now, if we want to be in a position where if we do get put up against a back wall, we have really other viable options there. But I think that those are always our options in the back of our back pocket, and we're not putting those on the table. But we also do want to say that our sport is more than 2,000 meter racing as well. The interesting thing you said about cycling did that before the limits came in.
Yeah.
So I think it's limits, a different world now.
The limits are athlete headcount, is that correct?
There's a number of limits. Some of them is headcounts, total headcounts. The other one is the total number of medals. And of course, the other one is the cost of the venues. So that those become interesting. I think the other element that we really struggle with a little bit in the explaining of our sport on the Olympic stage to the IOC members is that we're team sport, but we're also individual boats. And so we're not like triathlon, which will only have a male medal and a female medal, and maybe a team if they go for that option. So we're not just going to have one male and one female. We've got eight singles and doubles. So we look like we're individuals, but we also a team in there as well. And there aren't too many sports that that look the same as that. Canoeing and sailing would be in there as well.
And the relay maybe. So other sports are also being challenged at this extraordinary congress. This isn't just a let's pick on rowing. It's a discussion about every single sport that may be represented in 2020 in Tokyo.
Absolutely, yes. So every sport is looking really hard at their formats. Some sports have made some really exciting. Modern pentathlon has been changing its formats for years, and completely changed the sport itself. There's some really exciting stuff in there, but at the same time, we mustn't lose the integrity of what it is to be an Olympic rower.
Well, I wish you all the best, and I recognise that you and the team from FISA have got a very challenging job, and I hope, when will the final decision be made?
So the recommendation that will go to the IOC will be announced probably on Sunday. You look out to the press wiring from World Rowing, look out then, Congress is on Saturday, this coming Saturday. The IOC decisions will be made in the forthcoming months, I think maybe 2 or 3 months ahead. I'm not exactly sure on those dates. Focusing, I think, on this coming weekend more than anything else.
Now, I want to move back to talk a little bit about young people and sport and rowing and what you think clubs can do around the world to encourage more young people to come into the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. I think one of the real fundamental positions that we as society need to work with our young people with is to make sure they're safe in and on water. And I think that's where we work in partnership with swimming to make sure that our young people understand the dangers, but also can swim well enough to get on and really enjoy what the water gives us. I think there are some real challenges in many parts of the world. The water's not clean enough. So access to clean water is a real challenge. In countries where there is a culture and the water is clean enough for people to get on and in, I think it's an incredibly important part of young people's growth and development as young people. And there's something really that young people can learn from rowing, which again, if I come back to, we're a team sport, but we're not quite a team sport. We're a little bit more than that. If I play football or I play hockey, I can be man of the match. I don't know how many man of the rowing boats or women of the rowing boats we've ever had. You're only as good as your team. And that may well be the weakest person in your boat. It's in your interest to make sure that you support that weakest person to become the best they can possibly be, because your outcome is resting on their shoulders. Whereas in a team sport like hockey or netball or cricket or whatever, you can almost isolate them out and minimize their impact. In a rowing boat, your weakest member, you've got to encourage them to raise their game and support them. And that creates an incredible bond within the boat. And it's a really great and practical way that young people can instantly learn how to work within a team setting.
And rowing, I would guess, is not actually singing this particular theme tune particularly well. People do not understand that one of the benefits of the sport is as much as anything about personal development and team building than just the physicality of doing a sport. How do you think we can improve that?
I work for a charity called the Youth Sport Trust, and I've worked with them since I retired as an athlete and spent a lot of time working out how we can use the vehicle of physical education and sport to develop our young people. And I think if you look at physical education teachers, or you look at universities who teach our teachers, and you listen to coaches, and you ask them, you know, what are your young people learning? They're saying they're learning to move, but they're also learning all these skills. You ask the kids, they usually can't articulate that they're learning all these skills until they get older. And I think one of the critical things we as coaches, physical education teachers, or anybody, parents, are encouraging is to help young people to be more aware of the skills that they're learning, the life skills and employability skills that they're learning through sport, to empower them to go on and be successful in their lives. And actually, the be-all and end-all of sport, while it might be for your high-performance athletes and your and our Olympic systems, is to win. The reason why we do sport is to for enjoyment, for mental health, for emotional health, physical well-being, and fun. You know, and for our young people, it's helping them to be part, a really integral part of society. But I could be here for about 2 hours explaining this. but I think it's a great thing. But we need to help our young people to understand what they're learning while they're learning it, because they'll gain even more from it when they do it.
And on the flip side, if you're part of a rowing club committee of management, the sorts of things that you can do are to explain on your website, which is probably read by your parents rather than the children themselves, the sorts of things that children get out of it. And I run a small master's rowing group, not aimed at children, but at older people, particularly older people who want to get into sport for the first time. And the thing that attracts people to our club more than anything else is one sentence on our website where we say that we go rowing and then we go to a cafe afterwards and have breakfast. And people understand from that one sentence that it's about the community. It's about sitting around and chatting and having breakfast and a cup of coffee together, as well as doing something physical on the water. And we know for certain, because people tell us, that that was why they chose our club over another club. And we don't even need to provide the cafe facilities. They're just local to where we row.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a fantastic message. I mean, every club's going to be putting that on. on their website now. It's because you're basically saying you care about people as much as you care about the result of rowing.
Exactly.
Rowing is a people sport.
Yeah. And when I coached children, I used to coach 10 to 14 year olds, and they all came from different schools and different backgrounds. And one of the things that we enjoyed particularly in looking at the nice, fun group of young people who learned to be friends with a lot of different young people was the fact that the rowing itself formed a great equalizer between the sexes and between the ages. Because, of course, between the ages of 10 and 14, you're growing, and women tend to grow younger than men. And so the young girls would often beat the boys when they were 10, 11, 12, 13. And then, of course, the boys would start growing and then they'd be physically larger and stronger and could beat the girls. And so some of the life skills that come out of learning to be beaten by a girl, which, of course, from some people's point of view might be seen as negative, actually enables them to come away with a greater understanding of life and competition, and that it's extremely hard to always be the best. And the fact that you have to get together with the rest of your crew in order to have an enjoyable experience. And I don't suspect, as you say, that they would have articulated it like that, but certainly the mixed sex scenario for young people was really, really beneficial. And I don't know if other clubs do it in that way, but we definitely did, just because we had a diverse group of children and we had to work out a way of giving them all a row.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you develop enormous respect for people when you train with them, you race with them. And I think that transcends some of the challenges society brings to us, whether or not, you know, it's because you're a boy or a girl, or whether or not it's because you're from the right end of town or the wrong end of town. It's a fantastic environment to experiment and to meet people.
Now, I'd like to ask you one last thing, which is about different types of rowing boats. Now, we know that the sport can be very expensive, but when we talked before the show, you mentioned that stand-up paddle boards now have rowing boat adaptability. How does that work?
Yeah, so I've been it's quite interesting. I when I was a when I was starting out and getting on the water and round boats, so you looked at things, and then of course I went into river and lake rowing, and of course, you know, there was only one thing, and I wanted to be the fastest, sharpest, carbonest, stiffest thing that was out there. You know, and then when I, you know, actually now what I want is I don't want to have to spend stacks of money paying for this thing that's going to sit on the rack, and then of course I'm just going to get weaker and weaker and worse at rowing. And you know, so how can I do it on my holidays? How can I have something I can keep in my back garden? How can I just enjoy being out there? And this, what I tried to identify was what was the bit about it that made me enjoy it? And it's basically the stiffness of the pin, okay, the oar against the pin. You always need good oars. The pin, the stiffness of the pin against your feet. And so if you're looking for to buy a rowing boat, or you're looking to buy anything that's out there, check that stiffness. There are some boats out there that are really cheap in the market in respects that you can get and still have a fantastic experience on them. There's also some boats out there that are boat manufacturers out there that claim to make great boats, but actually that stiffness has gone. So I would definitely recommend to everybody, you know, if you're going to buy something, try it and look for that stiffness, because that stiffness is going to give you the sensation of acceleration speed that we all in rowing want to have. The other bit to probably look at is if you're going to buy something that's small and light, it's probably going to be short. And of course, we know that in the way we row at the moment, whereas the body is sliding up and down, we need quite a long boat to stop the pitching from taking place. Now, if you go in a shorter, lighter boat that you can put on top of your car, you get take a sliding rigger. You don't need as long a boat. Okay, so what you'll find is on the stand-up paddle boards or on the surfboards, so the contraptions that go on those, it's probably better to get a sliding seat combination. I mean, sorry, a sliding rigger combination on there, because then you can have a shorter, you have the shorter paddle board. But go and try them. I was amazed. I'd always do, go, no, it's going to be too soft. But actually, I was out in the US about a year ago, and I managed to, somebody persuaded me to get on one of them, and I loved it. It's great. It couldn't get me off the water. So, yeah.
And they will go through surf as well as go on flat water, is that right?
Yeah, I think really, you know, you need to check. You need to go and try them and talk to the manufacturer, because there's about five or six different manufacturers out there at the moment. So go and try them, go and talk to them. I mean, they'll always be the boat builders are probably very genuine and very honest. They will be very genuine and honest with you. Yeah, I'd try them, I think. And then if you love them when you try them, then buy them.
There we go. So that's a recommendation for everybody. And a theme I think that I can summarize from our chat today, which is you're encouraging people to try different formats of rowing, whether traditional or new formats, and to get out there and have a go at things that perhaps you wouldn't have thought of trying when before.
Yeah, and
When
people can always go out on the ocean if they need to. Sorry, there you go. Anyway, for another time, hey, I should shut up now and let you finish.
No, I would love to talk to you again about ocean rowing and what you learned out in the Maldives. It sounds amazing. And so, Gwyn, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you for sharing your expertise, your insights, and your genuine passion and enthusiasm for all sorts of rowing. You're an ambassador for the sport, and it's been a real pleasure having you here on Rowing Chat.
Thank you.